Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is February 19th, 2025. We have three cases on our calendar set for oral argument today. This is the second of those cases. This is A24-0818, State of Minnesota versus Alfredo Torres. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. We do have a timer. There's a square that indicates how much time you have, so please be mindful of that. This oral argument is being held via Zoom, and there will be an oral recording that will be available to all the parties after, within the next day or two. However, no other recordings of this proceeding are permitted. If we do run into technical issues, which does happen on occasion, we'll make sure that we accommodate the party so that you have sufficient time for your arguments. And with that, counsel for appellant, please state your name for the record, the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joseph McInnes, and I represent Alfredo Torres. Mr. Torres's pleas must be withdrawn because they were coerced, they were unintelligent, and his defense counsel gave him ineffective assistance of counsel at his plea withdrawal hearing. So, first of all, these pleas were coerced because the prosecutor used Mr. Torres's terminally ill wife's liberty as leverage to extract a guilty plea from him. They were unintelligent because Mr. Torres was suffering from dementia throughout these proceedings. He indicated that numerous times in the record, and he even requested an interpreter due to his failing ability to communicate, and that was denied. And he received ineffective assistance of counsel at the plea withdrawal hearing because his defense counsel essentially, for lack of a better word, sabotaged his plea withdrawal. There was Mr. Torres was bringing a plea withdrawal under a fair and just standard, and defense counsel essentially cabined that request for plea withdrawal under the one category that would not fulfill the fair and just standard. And meanwhile, in the same hearing, Mr. Torres was expressing a fair and just reason for plea withdrawal by describing to the court his symptoms of his cognitive decline and expressing.
So, Mr. McGinnis, I want to, if I could interrupt, you referenced his dementia, and but I didn't see anything in the record indicating that he had gone to the doctor, much less had a diagnosis of dementia. And I mean, I realize that that's not conclusive in and of itself, but it also indicated during his plea hearing that he understood the proceedings, that he understood the terms of the plea, and that he also understood and had explained to him the terms by his attorney at that time. So while there are a couple of statements that he made regarding dementia, he also clearly indicated at his plea that he understood everything that was going on. So why should there,
Well,
I'm struggling with
I
your
think,
argument there.
yes. Yeah, so in terms of the plea hearing, the court never conducted the Daun inquiry, the more robust inquiry into his waiver of rights, much less conducting just a simple Rule 15 inquiry. And so, and his defense counsel never completed a Rule 15 petition with him. So.
Well, counsel, I would agree with you that there's The district court didn't say, okay, now I'm going to undertake a separate analysis of the Dawn factors. But the district court did note that, mentioned the evidence that the state had against appellant. It took ju judicial notice of the prior cases and convictions that appellant had, which were extensive. The judge also noted that he had been very, very familiar with appellant, as well as the prior cases, as well as the cases involving appellant's wife and his son, and that so there's acknowledgement of different aspects of the Dawn factors throughout the transcripts. Why isn't that sufficient?
That's not sufficient because the court never conducted an inquiry into the coercive impact, which is the most critical Dawn factor. So the court never asked Mr. Torres, are you pleading guilty here in order to preserve your ill wife's liberty? And if the court had asked that question, I think the answer was obviously yes, and that's a coercive plea. And Don talks about that, and Don cites to Ibarra and Dupree, which both talk about the, if the significant factor in pleading guilty is someone else's liberty, then that's a coerced plea. And I would also state that the prosecutor himself acknowledged multiple times in the record that the reason why Mr. Torres was pleading guilty, the big consideration, was saving his wife from incarceration.
Mr.
So I
McGinnis, why? Let's assume that the district court did not, as Judge Reyes indicated, seem to make an express analysis of the Dawn factors. Why isn't remedy or why isn't remand the appropriate remedy so that the district court could make findings? But I don't read you as asking for a remedy. You're just asking this court to grant plea withdrawal. So how can this court give you the relief that you're asking for in the absence of findings by the district court?
Well, Don expressly states that in future cases where the district court neglects this specialized analysis, the remedy is plea withdrawal. And that's because, going back to Boykin and the Supreme Court decision, our Supreme Court decision, and State v. Caceres, the record of voluntariness has to be made at the plea hearing. That's a requirement of due process. And when the court omits the Dawn inquiry, when it omits the Rule 15 inquiry, and it omits a Rule 15 petition, that plea hearing record lacks a record of voluntariness, and the remedy is under Dawn is plea withdrawal. And I would
I
also
could be remembering wrong, but didn't Don remand for a post-conviction hearing on the voluntariness of the plea?
That is absolutely correct, but Don states in all future cases, the remedy is plea withdrawal. And that's based on Boykin and Caceres. And I think this case illustrates why that remedy is it isn't enough for us just to be remanded, because Mr. Torres has gone to the DOC. He's now been diagnosed with a neurocognitive disorder, and he's, he we're not in a position
Counsel, is
to
that part of the record?
no, that subsequent the subsequent diagnosis at the DOC is not part of the record. But his statement that he's, his repeated statements throughout the proceedings that he can't remember, that his memory is that he's unable to consult with counsel because of his lack of memory and his problems remembering, that he can't understand the proceedings. All of those statements are in the record. And
Right, but we do have the statements before at the plea hearing that contradict those statements later made at the plea withdrawal hearing,
well,
correct?
even during the plea hearing, he's discussing his cognitive difficulties. At the plea hearing on page 15, he says, I'm losing my mind. I feel like I'm losing my mind because, my memory is all of a sudden going, and is failing me. So he does, and he states as well, when the court asks him, do you have any questions about all of these important rights? He states, I do have questions, but I forgot them. And that's on page 14 of the plea hearing. So I think this is throughout the record.
What is the significance, in your view, if anything, to the fact that there was new counsel at the t by the time of sentencing, and the new counsel did not appear to raise any concerns about a Rule 20 issue, about being disabled in communication, about a coercive plea? Is there any significance to that, the fact that there was new counsel?
I think there's no significance whatsoever to that. The failure, the ineffective, the crucial failure of defense counsel in this case occurred at the plea hearing or at the plea withdrawal hearing. And so that's what I am focusing my arguments on.
I guess as to the plea withdrawal hearing and the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, again, is it significant that the fact that the client himself was able to testify as to the reasons he wanted plea withdrawal? I mean, to the extent that the lawyer, seemed to indicate that the plea withdrawal motion was just based on a change of heart or a change of mind. But then the defendant had ample opportunity to explain directly to the court, to the extent there were other reasons or different reasons. Doesn't that tend to indicate, I mean, maybe that's relevant to prong two of Strickland. I don't know.
Yes, and so I think what is most troubling about the plea withdrawal hearing is that Mr. Torres does have there is I would say a small window for him to talk about what the issues going on, and he does talk about that. He talks about his memory, and he says on page 9 he says to his counsel, well, it's like I've been telling you, I don't know if I've been getting dementia. And he talks about the problems that that's created in his being able to express himself and his being able to consult with counsel. And then immediately after that statement, which would be a fair and just reason for plea withdrawal, I think kind of indisputably, especially when the state has said that there's no prejudice that they would suffer. Immediately after that statement by Mr. Torres, defense counsel asks the leading question. So what this boils down to is that you've just changed your mind. And I think that's that, defense counsel's statement that the prosecutor's brief was comprehensive and he took no issue with it, that the court could deny the motion. I mean, those are, I think, concessions. And without Mr. Torres's consent about the motion, but then to cabin a valid reason for plea withdrawal and to take that valid reason and reshape it and repackage it and put it and describe it as being a change of mind, that is the, I think, the crucial point where counsel's where the Sixth Amendment breaks down here, where counsel was completely ineffective and failed to advocate for his client.
Well, counsel, a lot of the case law with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel, and the cases that you cite, and I'd be interested in your take on the Epps case, which is a very recent case in which there is a finding that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel for not seeking a competency evaluation. But the cases in which ineffective assistance of counsel has been found is usually when there's a complete absence of any advocacy whatsoever. I understand you may argue and take issue with the extent of the advocacy here, but there still was advocacy on behalf of appellant here. I mean, there are arguments made, and he could only do so much with what information that appellant was providing him as well, correct?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I do not, I, you know, when the client is stating, I can't remember, and because of my memory, I can't consult with you and I express myself in court, counsel has an absolute duty to request a Rule 2001 in that instance. And that is also a fair and just reason for him to withdraw his plea. So it was, I believe it was a complete failure of advocacy. There was no advocacy when when defense counsel then states, well, Your Honor, he's just changed his mind. That the counsel knows in that moment that a change of mind is not a fair and just reason. And he knows that any issue with his client's ability to understand or consult with him is a Rule 20 issue and is a fair and just issue. And he chose the issue that was completely that had no strategic value whatsoever to this circumstance and would essentially be a concession of his client's motion. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now turn to counsel for respondent. You will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record, the party you are representing. You may begin.
Hermanson, on behalf of the state of Minnesota, respondent in this case, first like to note a token of appreciation allowing me to substitute in on short notice here, given my office's frustrations, Your Honors. This case we describe as mostly a no evidence case, or at least no evidence on the issues that the appellant is raising here. His statements under oath when he pled guilty refute a lot of the claims here raised on appeal. Specifically, at the plea hearing, appellant was advised of his constitutional rights, waived his right to a trial. He specifically testified that he was born in Texas, that he could read and write in English, that he'd been able to communicate effectively with his counsel at the time, Mr. Brew. And Mr. Brew had answered all of his questions, that Mr. Brew had discussed the plea agreement with him, was satisfied with Mr. Brew's representation of him, that he was not suffering from any physical or mental impairment, never had been diagnosed with a mental illness or emotional disturbance. He testified that he understood what was going on, that it was in his best interest to resolve the case in this fashion, especially given the consideration for his wife. They understood what he was doing by pleading guilty, and when prosecution noted that jury was assembled, that the exhibits were ready, that witnesses were subpoenaed, that appellant stated emphatically that he did not want a jury trial. District court has already made credibility findings here based on the withdrawal motion. The district court, in their order denying motion to withdraw guilty pleas, found pleas for voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, as well as that the defendant's or the appellant's testimony at the plea hearing was more credible and believable than any statements, affidavits, or testimony that he had presented or asserted after the plea hearing.
Counsel, can I just cut in? Can you address the ineffective assistance of counsel at the plea withdrawal hearing? It's a little concerning to me that counsel seemed to agree with the merits of the state's memorandum and sort of used the words that, as Mr. McInnes point out, are not a fair and just reason to withdraw a plea. Why wasn't that deficient performance, given that the defendant himself then testified to additional reasons that he wanted to withdraw the plea?
So in order to deficient, it has to meet both the prongs of Strickland, and as also addressed in the respondent's brief, the alternative grounds that were being addressed would not have been a granted motion as the respondent's position. And so that meritless motion or alternative motion or the lack of filing or addressing the plea withdrawal under that basis would not be a basis for ineffective assistance of counsel since it would not have been successful on its merits, Your Honor.
So that's prong two, I think, that you're referring to. And what is your position on prong one of Strickland?
On prong one for Strickland, whether or not a reasonable attorney would act as counsel did in this case, I think the main issue here is the fine line that defense counsel found themselves in. Their client is the appellant is looking to withdraw his plea, and even if they were to assert the alternative grounds that he was having cognitive defects or was unable to remember and needed a Rule 20 evaluation, that would run contrary to his statements under oath at the plea hearing and possibly endanger him to a possible perjury charge. If he had to testify in two situations under oath with conflicting statements, Your Honor. So given that situation and that the client is requesting to make a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, defense counsel is left with advancing the only basis that he believed he could in order to put a motion before the court to substantiate it with some amount of record and not risk perjury for his client.
On the plea itself, why isn't it appropriate on the Don factors to at least remand to have the district court consider and make findings on those factors, in particular the coerciveness factor?
So, in relation to the Don factors, Don has not been applied mechanically and reflexively, simply because it wasn't addressed at the plea hearing in State v. Butala. It was addressed at a post-conviction hearing, and on appeal, that was found to have been a sufficient addressing of that issue. More recently, in an unpublished opinion, State v. Bacon, it was not addressed at the district court during the plea hearing. There was not, to my recollection, a post-conviction hearing to address it. However, this court was able to determine on the record that there was clearly no coerciveness.
What are we to make, though, that here there's no separate? It seems like the district court didn't really follow the requirement under Don to basically hold a separate hearing, or not a separate hearing, but specifically go above and beyond the Rule 15 inquiry. What are we to make of that?
Your Honor, I believe we're to make it that to the same thing that Butala and Bacon did. And while the language of Don is quite explicit, as Appellant has noted, that when that inquiry is not done, Don does state that plea withdrawal should be the remedy. However, that's not how it's been applied in either Butala or Bacon. And again, Bacon, of course, is an unpublished opinion. And so this court would be limited to the record in front of it, and conceivably, it could remand for post-conviction proceedings. Alternatively, appellant could have sought post-conviction relief prior to the appeal to address that as well. And Your Honors, appellant had touched on, or during appellant's argument, there was touch on the Epps case, and I did want to take a moment. In appellant's reply brief, they seem to misstate or miscategorize the respondent's reliance upon Epps. Specifically, the Epps case involved a situation where a defendant had significantly more history and documentation relating concerns about their competency. And yet, despite that significant volume of evidence, defense counsel, prosecutor, and the district court, none of which felt compelled under the rules to request or undergo Rule 20 proceedings. And on appeal, it was found that that was not a mandatory requirement. Concerning Epps, or applying Epps to this case, where the record is virtually silent other than a few comments during different court hearings, and two independently working defense attorneys, who neither of which raised a Rule 20 issue, the presumption being that the attorneys were competent and effective. And I believe that appellant hasn't even alleged ineffective assistance counsel of Mr. Rivers, who represented at the sentencing hearing. That issue of whether or not a competency hearing should have been addressed by counsel or retroactively by the or sua sponte by the court does not comply with Epps's holding.
Doesn't it though? I mean, we have a criminal defendant pleading guilty, facing a significant penalty, who is making statements at multiple hearings about inability to remember, about having dementia. I mean, shouldn't somebody, either the court or the parties, have done a follow-up inquiry to ensure that the plea was voluntary because of that, or or even at sentencing?
It I mean, it's hard to argue against a situation where you're advocating for more in a record. And so while I wouldn't say that it would be completely inappropriate for someone to have asked some additional inquiry, the presumption here is that a defense attorney who is meeting with the client, who is speaking with them regularly and having that one-on-one conversation would be in the best position to make determinations on competency. And again, we have two defense attorneys here, neither of which, in their conversations with appellant, felt that it rose to the level under their obligations to request a Rule 20 evaluation.
But just to follow up on that point, I mean, the prosecutor is an officer of the court and has an obligation to raise an issue, including on competency. And furthermore, we have a district court judge who freely acknowledged that he knew of appellant. Appellant had appeared in front of him before. Appellant was 62 years old. And yes, his attorneys probably familiar with him, but the district court judge in this particular case was very familiar with him. So why didn't the district court fail to the district court's failure to request a competency evaluation? Why isn't that cause for concern and reversal here?
Well, Your Honor, if well, first to find that the district court failed by not inquiring further on a Rule 20 would be to find different than the Epps case. Second, I completely agree. Prosecutor is officer of the court, and the district court also have obligations under Rule 20 that if they have reason to doubt the competency of a defendant, to raise that and request Rule 20 evaluation. Here, both the prosecutor and the district court are familiar with the appellant throughout history. Their observations of him throughout the court process did not lead them to have a doubt as to his competency compared to his previous appearances in court. Is the only conclusion that can be drawn from the record here. And Your Honors, while it didn't come up in argument, appellant does cite to chronic as an issue relating to failure to contest the state's case. The respondent's argument here is that chronic actually doesn't apply in this situation. That requires a complete failure of representation as opposed to not contesting a specific aspect of a case. And my understanding from appellant's argument here is that really the issue is one, perhaps two primary point or focus points. First being the elicited testimony at the motion to withdraw a guilty plea, as well as the motion itself, and then by not requesting the or an independent Rule 20 evaluation, Your Honors. Those specific points fall more adequately under the Strickland analysis and not the chronic analysis, Your Honors. And the last issue that was raised by appellant in filings but did not make it to argument today is the issue on sentencing, Your Honors. It would largely rest on the written submissions relating to the sentencing of both count one and count four here, primarily indicating that there's case law where both conspiracy and a substantive offense or a part of that conspiracy are not part of the same behavioral incident under 609.035. Additionally, here, both the substantive sale offense in count one and the conspiracy offense in count four can be proven independent of each other. It is not necessary to have had the first degree sale as a part of the conspiracy for the basis. With that, Your Honors, I've wrapped up the basic summary of respondents' argument and open more questions.
And seeing none, if there's anything else otherwise, thank you for your arguments, and we will turn back over to appellant. And you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. We'll have that up on the screen here in just a second. There we go, and you may proceed.
All right, thank you. I'd like to, first of all, talk about Don, and just to cite directly to Don's statement about the fact that the Rule 15.01 inquiry cannot adequately discover coercion in these cases, and therefore imposes the duty on the trial court to conduct further inquiries to determine whether the plea is voluntarily made. And then it states, quoting at 5 542 to 543. In future cases, a defendant must be allowed to withdraw his or her guilty plea if the state fails to inform the trial court of the nature of the plea, or if the trial court fails to adequately inquire into the voluntariness of the plea at the time of the guilty plea. And so that I think is the, that is the authority from Don that I think directs that Mr. Torres's plea should be that he should be granted plea withdrawal as a result of the district court's failure to conduct those inquiries.
Counsel, can you address so you know we have Don, but then we have a couple cases, one
yes.
Precedential, non-precedential, that apply Don. We've got the Butala case, which is a precedential, and then the Bacon case, which is non-precedential.
Correct.
Address those briefly.
Yes, and I would add to that that there is a, this court has a precedential case, State v. Lopez, 794 Northwest 2nd, 379, which applies Don and Butala, and it also requires the plea withdrawal. There's several unpublished cases that touch on this issue, not just Bacon. Butala basically reiterates the holding of Don and reaffirms it. And Butala dealt with an offer by the prosecutor to not prosecute the defendant's family members. However, in Butala, there was, unlike this case, there was no risk to the defendant's family members. The police agencies had already written letters to the prosecutor saying that there was no possibility of prosecution against those family members. Here we have the very real existing prosecution of family members in unrelated matters. And under Ibarra, which is cited by Don, that is a factor which is shows greater coercion. And I think Butala also recognizes Don's holding that the remedy where a Rule 15 inquiry is neglected and the Don inquiry is neglected, that the proper remedy is plea withdrawal. Epps dealt with, and if I may correct one thing, Mr. Torres was 72 years old at the time of the plea. He's now 73, about to turn 74. Epps dealt with a defendant who, though he had a significant past history of mental illness, because he had been treated, his attorney at the time of his case believed that he was competent, and so did the court. And this court did not force a defense attorney to ask for a Rule 20 solely based on a person's history. Here, Mr. Torres stated that he had never seen a doctor before. So obviously he had no medical history whatsoever and no psychological history that could be access. So it's not surprising that there's a difference between his background and the background of the defendant in Epps. That is not dispositive at all as to the question of what was his ability at the time of these proceedings to consult with counsel and to understand the proceedings.
Counsel, can I ask a quick question before your time runs out on the 609035 issue?
Yes.
Do you agree that the Heath case is the most on point authority because it addresses multiple sentences in the context of a conspiracy and a sale?
No, and I believe in a lot of these cases, Heath, Lucio, and those cases we're seeing Heath is the defendant's rented a garage, outfitted it to produce methamphetamines, and then they were also caught later, subsequently, with methamphetamines. So there's a temporal break there, and I believe that this court's analysis of Conspiracy being a continuing offense in Omaha is particularly instructive, and it's also important to distinguish the federal cases, which are deciding a double jeopardy claim, from our 609.035 claim, which has nothing to do with whether the offenses can be tried separately, but it's an inquiry into whether this factual incident is one behavioral incident. And I, seeing as my time is up, I would ask that this court reverse Mr. Torres's convictions and grant him plea withdrawal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing on this matter. We appreciate it. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.